Chapter 6.
Reports are coming in of a major battle between Sekan forces and invading Chekot troops on the Seeka homeworld. The Sekan administration has called for Galactic Alliance forces to intervene in what it calls an act of opportunist aggression, and share prices have tumbled over fears that the invasion will draw more planets in the expansion region into the conflict.
HNE Newsflash. Galactic Alliance Warship Bounty, on station with Alliance Frigate Daring, Bothan Sector. It was a tidy-looking vessel. She had to admit that. The new Bothan frigate wasn't even in their database. Admiral Neothel watched it on Bounty's bridge screen, curving out of Bethawi orbit, trailed by five small unarmed tenders. The profile and signature were immediately logged in the ship's recognition systems.
"Looks like the Bothans have been shopping after all," she said. "At least the intel was right on that."
"Seems they're still doing workups, too," said Captain Pyrrhus.
The warship was being assisted by the tenders. Or maybe it was simply feigning helplessness. Neothel never took Bothans at face value.
"Let's see what specs we can collate on them before we scratch the paintwork. I hope they kept their receipts."
"KDY construction, do you think?"
"Talon," Pyrrhus said. "We'd know if Kuat was building them."
"Well, they're not going to level Coruscant with those. But they certainly will spread us thin if they've got as many as intelligence estimates."
Admiral Neothel shared a number of military philosophies with Jason Solo, and being seen on the front line was one of them. She also liked to see things for herself, especially if Galactic Alliance intelligence was involved. The current overstretch gave her cause to wonder what Cal Omis was playing at, an anxiety that might have been visible to the bridge crew as she paced up and down, glancing over shoulders to check screens and readouts.
"We need every hull we can hang on to, Admiral."
Bounty's commanding officer, Pyrrhus, had been on the bridge far too long. He was a Quarren, evolved for an amphibious existence, and the atmosphere on board was too dry to keep pulling double watches. His uniform was sealed tightly at the cuffs and neck, but he kept wiping his face with a moist cloth. He needed a rest in his humid cabin.
"If the Bothan fleet is growing as fast now as intelligence suggests, then I fail to see how we're going to contain it if we have to support Seeka and every other local skirmish, too."
"Looks like the Chemstore I dispute will be the next to boil over."
Neothel had a brief moment of wishing that she could target one world, reduce its surface to slag from orbit just to make her point, and then ask who else wanted some of the same. But it passed. It always did.
"Every backworld with a grievance is resurrecting old fights in the guise of Alliance loyalty and asking us to help out. And Omis thinks he can hold the Alliance together by placating every call for a backup fleet across the galaxy."
"When is he going to admit he can't?"
"When I give him no other option, I think."
Maybe the Bothans were ahead of the curve. Instead of commissioning more capital ships, juicy, high-value targets in battle, they'd opted for a big fleet of smaller, more agile warships that could be stockpiled without anyone panicking about the escalation in arms.
"It's a different kind of war. Flexibility and rapid response. That's the name of the game now."
Pyrrhus put his hand on the ship's comm control.
"Let's see what they're made of. Mothma Squadron, launch when ready. Karasi Squadron, remain on alert 5. Confine them to their own space, but attack if fired upon."
Neothel still wondered who'd assassinated the Bothans and kicked off this escalation.
"Could have been our assets if we'd played the Bothans right."
Some intel moron, she decided. She'd get to the bottom of that sooner or later. If she was going to be chief of state one day, she'd weed out the loose cannons first.
If you can get our furry friends to give us a ship's tour in one piece,
she suggested. But intercepting and boarding the new frigate in these circumstances was next to impossible. The best break they'd get would be to retrieve debris for inspection.
I'd love to know their top speed.
Neothel quite liked Bothans, even if she didn't trust them as far as she could spit, which was a lot farther than anyone might have believed. She didn't dislike Quarren either, even if it was almost expected of Mon Calamari. Quarren were a rare sight on ships. She knew Mon Cal officers who made every effort to avoid being assigned Quarren crew, and few Quarren wanted to serve alongside Mon Cals even now. But when they were good, they were very, very good. Pyrrhus was outstanding. If she caught any Mon Cal referring to him as Squidhead, they'd answer to her, and she didn't care how many whispered that she was an apologist.
Did we have the right to take their kids for some social engineering experiment? For our benefit?
She asked herself that question more often these days, and the answer always came up negative. Jason Solo would think she was a hopeless, wet liberal. She wondered how she was going to wipe him off her boots when the time came. It wouldn't be easy.
Bounty, Daring, stand by.
12 fighters shot out of the Bounty's hangar bay, spiraling away from the warship and streaking off in pursuit of the Bothan frigate. Then the three flights separated. Observation cams in each cockpit gave Bounty's combined bridge and combat information center a composite view of the engagement. Daring sat off Bounty's starboard bow, ready to divert any Bothan retaliation from her larger charge.
"Did you ever train as a pilot, ma'am?"
Pyrrhus asked.
"No. You?"
"Indeed I did. At times like this, I miss it."
"If we get any busier, Captain, there'll be a droid running this ship, and you'll be flying sorties. Where that leaves me, I have no idea."
"You'll be Chief of State, ma'am," said Pyrrhus.
The worst thing about Quarren was that their amusement wasn't as easy to spot as a human's. With a human, all those teeth on display made life easier. Quarren face tentacles could hide a multitude of emotions.
"That'll be the day,"
she said, hoping to avoid more gossip about her ambitions. Right then, being Chief of State didn't matter at all. She had a battle, and all her training and instinct kicked in to say this was where she wanted to be, not behind a desk. The first flight to come within range of the Bothan frigate shadowed it, cutting back and forth across its path at 1,000 meters. The second flight trailed aft of it, scanning the hull and sending back data. It took a few seconds for the Bothans to react. Perhaps some of their systems were still offline. The ship picked up speed and began to move out of the Bethawi limits, its accompanying tenders trailing like escort fish. So the Bothans thought they had a nice new asset to surprise the Alliance. But the Alliance had spotted it. Neothel waited for the reaction while the third flight of Mothma Squadron monitored the situation, weapons trained but not locked. There was no point blowing it to pieces before they'd taken the measure of the new class.
"Very heavy hull plating for a frigate,"
said Neothel, looking at the recce scans coming back from the starfighters. Pyrrhus pored over the images and penetrating scans, too.
"At least 12 turbo lasers and 20 cannons."
"Not exceptional."
"Depends how many hulls they have."
They didn't have long to wait to find out how many vessels were out there. the weapons officer shouted at the same time as the sensor warning klaxon sounded.
Sir, enemy contact at...
Correction, multiple contacts in range. We've got trade.
Bounty, Daring, close up at battle stations. Synchronize command information. Helm, all ahead. Karasi Squadron, launch! Bronzium and remainder of air group, launch when ready.
Nobody said ambush. The cockpit chatter from the pilots broke in.
Copy that. 5, 6...
Correction, 10. Detecting cannons charging. We'll engage.
Targeting source.
I make that 19. He's got a lock on me. Got your 6. Deploying chaff.
Pyrrhus's face tentacles were completely still. It gave him a commendable look of calm.
Cannons, engage all Bothan vessels in range. In your own time. Go on.
One moment, they'd been watching a single fresh-out-of-the-box frigate, and the next, more were dropping out of hyperspace at regular 5-second intervals. Mothma Squadron picked up images on their cockpit cams, all in the same Bothan livery, all brand-spanking new and unmarked by debris, pox, and scrapes. A flare of red laser blazed on the screens as one XJ cam view winked out and the fighter broke up into spinning red-hot debris. Pilots' voices were still audible in the background, but the focus on the bridge was on fighting the ship, attacking the enemy. Daring moved between Bounty and the Bothan flotilla. Her cannons and lasers showed up on the synchronized command information screen as blinking icons, fully charged and acquiring firing solutions.
8 contacts not firing, sir! And no sign of charging cannons!
Bounty shuddered from deflected pulsed laser fire. Neothel moved to supervise damage control, which was already under a competent commander, but there was nothing worse than an idle visiting admiral on a ship at battle stations. She needed to be occupied.
Take them out anyway.
Pyrrhus turned to Neothel.
If they cripple us, at least we transmitted the data we have. If they don't... That's a whole Bothan flotilla that never leaves home.
I don't expect a tactical withdrawal, Captain.
3 more XJs were hit. Neothel noted it as lost assets, not knowing the pilots personally, and disliked her detachment for a moment. She always did.
We're here. Let's do as much damage as we can.
The Bothans, of course, had the same goal. 2 Bothan frigates were on a ramming course with Bounty. Of the remaining flotilla, 5 were firing on the XJs. Daring opened fire. The bridge crew watched as a frigate's aft section rippled with a sequence of explosions before debris blew away from it and smashed into an XJ. 5 minutes into the engagement, Bounty's air group was taking a pounding, not all of it from direct hits. The second frigate veered away from the stream of fire from the XJ, a red-hot rip in its hull.
Their targeting's not affected by chaff measures, sir.
The pilot's voice was breathless with effort.
They're using narrow-range heatseekers. In future, we'll need to...
And he was gone, his cockpit cam blank and flickering.
Air group, pull out! Pyrrhus barked. Cannons, solutions on all targets, now!
Species perceive time differently in battle. For humans, it slowed because their brains took in far more detailed information about the threat. But that also meant they didn't notice low-priority things. But Mon Cal's and Quarren saw it all and factored in every cough and spit. That was what made them good commanders. Neothel's instinct was to fight back, and for a moment she couldn't imagine why she'd ever had designs on high office. She saw the tactical displays and heard the comm chatter, and the real-time 3-dimensional image in her mind showed her the whole battlefield, and she wanted to hit hard. 9 Bothan frigates were now disabled, either drifting with no sign of power, reduced to cold debris, or venting brief bursts of flame into the vacuum as they broke up. some of the remaining 10 returned fire for a further 30 seconds, then powered down their cannons.
"Surrendering?" asked the officer of the watch.
"They're preparing to jump," said Pyrrhus. Take.
7 frigates jumped in a tight sequence. 3 weren't so quick off the mark and took a furious barrage of laser and cannons. Pyrrhus gave Neothel a nod of relief and leaned over the command console.
"Air group, anyone too damaged to make an RV point?"
"Mothma 5-0, sir. Slow hull breach. Karasi 8, sir."
The bridge crew waited for a few seconds, utterly silent. Cannons still trained while XJs streaked back to the hangar and recovery units passed them outbound to haul in damaged craft.
"Secure hatches when ready and prepare to jump," Pyrrhus said. "Any sign of the Bothan cavalry arriving on long-range scans? No? Good."
He looked at the chrono hanging from a fob on his jacket.
"Not quite 20 minutes, Admiral. Now, was that a planned ambush we walked into? Or are the Bothans making the best of an unfortunately timed arrival? The score's 12-0 to us, not counting starfighters lost. But did we win or lose?"
"I'll let you know when our public information colleagues tell me," Neothel said. "But this confirms my position yet again. If we're stuck with the resources we've got, then we have to focus everything on Corellia, Kaminor, and now Bathawi. If the Chief of State wants to extend to every bushfire that's starting, he has to give us at least another fleet. And even if the Alliance had the credits, where would we get the personnel?"
Pyrrhus shrugged.
"All empires become too big and collapse under their own weight."
"Maybe that's what we're seeing."
Her body was telling her that it was all over now. She felt hot as her biochemical defenses rushed around looking for damage to repair, and found none. The aftermath of battle was always a restless hour or two for her, so she occupied herself wandering around the bridge, patting crew members on the back and telling them what a fine job they'd done. One young human male was wiping tears away with the back of his hand, his attention fixed unnaturally on the sensor screen in front of him. He'd lost a friend today, maybe more than one. There was nothing to say. She simply put her hand on his shoulder and stood there in silence for a while, until the helm crew began their checks before hyperjumping.
"I'll be in my day cabin," she said, pausing to shake Pyrrhus's hand. "Well done, Captain."
She knew what they'd be saying as soon as the bridge hatches closed behind her. They'd be expressing surprise that old Iceberg Face could go around patting backs and showing sympathy. Combat did that to her. She had a brief period of dropping her guard, and then she was back to normal, a politician who used to be a competent naval officer and still missed fleet action. The hyperspace vista from her cabin viewport was soothing. Sometimes she picked a streak of starlight that was stretched into a line and tried to think of it as a star with orbiting planets full of life and picture what was happening there. She did it now to clear her mind before deciding what to say to Cal Lomas. She knew she had to give him an ultimatum, and to make it stick, she needed Jason Solo to stand by her. GAG Headquarters, Coruscant. Captain Heol Gierdon smiled and beckoned Ben into a dark office. Somehow the two elements combined into Ben's least favorite way to spend an afternoon.
"Behold," he said, and Ben's eyes adjusted to the low light. There were no windows. The only illumination was from banks of holoscreens and monitors. Ben realized there were GAG troopers sitting at consoles, with that glaze of defocused concentration that looked like blank boredom. The eyes and ears of the guard. Welcome to the monitoring center. The ultimate in scrutiny.
Sir,
whispered one of the lieutenants,
keep the noise down, will you?
Gearden's grin was picked out in blue by the light from a frequency analyzer. They're all such artists. He steered Ben by his shoulder, taking him to an alcove away from the active consoles. Gearden probably didn't realize how well a Jedi could navigate in darkness, but Ben humored him. This is where we keep an eye on senators and other social misfits for their own good.
Whose calls do you tap?
Ben felt uneasy about it.
I bet it's not even exciting.
All government staff. Our special list of probable and proven scumbags. And politicians, said Gearden. And given the number of senators and the volume of hot air they emit, we get automated voice recognition systems to do it, or we'd be here for the next 1,000 years. If the droid picks up any keywords of interest, it tags the conversation and alerts us. Then we have to sit and actually listen to it. One of the troopers, Zavirk, was ladling sweetener into a cup of caff. He sipped it gingerly, looking slightly comical with an audio buffer lead dangling from his ear.
I joined the army to see the galaxy, he whispered, but all I got was 8-hour watches of listening to weird politicians making appointments to...
Ben's 14, Gearden said.
Well, if you want him to do monitoring, he's going to hear stuff that'll make his hair curl, sir.
Ben had never considered what tapping comlinks of suspects and people in sensitive posts actually entailed.
I won't faint, he said, and if I'm old enough to get shot at, I'm old enough to hear... stuff.
Can't argue with that logic. Gearden sat him down at a console and gave him an earpiece. Okay. The screen here shows you the sound files the droids lined up is worth listening to, as well as holocam footage. You just work through it and make notes if anything seems worth following up. You're looking for anyone who might be contacting senators and seems a bit odd. Any conversations about senators or government staff? Look, you're a Jedi. You've probably got a sixth sense about this stuff, just like you have about hidden explosives.
So do neck battle dogs, said Zavirk. But Lieutenant Skywalker smells better, and he can do tricks.
Ben decided he might like it here for a while. It didn't feel like Spy HQ at all, just a bunch of troopers he knew well doing a routine wartime surveillance job. Ben realized he'd partitioned his feelings so that he didn't have to think about Durgedjian as a person. The man had a wife and child. Tenel Ka had a child too, though, and Gedjian had been happy to hire someone to assassinate her. Ben had been weighing the morality of his mission and wasn't sure if he was only telling himself what he wanted to hear. And there was nobody he could talk it over with. He settled in his seat to begin checking recordings, and tried not to think about Gedjian. The conversations, mostly boring, some bizarre, a few incomprehensible, almost lulled him into meditation. It was an effort not to try hiding in the Force again, something he now practiced whenever he could. The monitoring center smelled strongly of caff. Ben felt in need of some, too, after a few hours, and he lost himself in a conversation between two government staff about the regular route that a certain senator took from the Senate to her apartment. But he was jerked out of his concentration by a rustle of fabric and quiet, intense activity at another console. Zavirk had summoned Gearden, and they both looked grim. Ben paused to listen.
You sure? Gearden asked.
Run a voice profile if you don't believe me, Zavirk said. That's the Corellian PM.
There were 10 people in the room, and they'd all stopped to listen. Gedgen's soothingly persuasive voice, with its faint accent, was telling someone that there was no point doing this through the usual channels, because nobody else was in a negotiating mood.
You and I know that this could be solved by the removal of a few hotheads. Some of our military needs slapping down, and so do some of yours. I'd call an immediate ceasefire if I could be assured of a few things.
Such as?
Said the unmistakable voice of Chief of State Omis. They were tapping the Chief of State's secure comm line. Ben wasn't sure they had authorization to do that.
We'll agree that Corellia pools its military assets with the GA as long as we have an opt-out clause that says we have the right to withdraw it if our own needs are more urgent. Neothel has to go. Jason Solo has to go. Once that's out of the way, we're back to normal and you've got what you want.
Center point.
Well, we're having problems repairing it anyway.
Center point has to be made inoperative.
A pause, too brief even for most people to notice, but Ben did.
It already is, but if you want a multiplanetary force or observers there, fine.
What about the Bothans? And the other planets fighting their own wars.
I can bring the Kaminoans into line, and the Bothans. Well, once we're all back in the GA, then Bethawi's got to toe the line. The little people, if the fighting gets out of hand, we'll commit troops to put a stop to that.
The Senate won't agree to this.
Take Neothel and Solo out of the equation first, and they'll calm down. What's left of the Senate, anyway?
Take out. They won't go quietly. They might split the Senate. Gasil's totally in their camp, and he's got weight.
Well, there's take out and take out.
Omis swallowed, but didn't respond. Gedgen filled the silence.
You know we have a job to do before this draws in the whole galaxy.
Okay. Okay.
We need to meet. Can you get to Volpter?
Long pause.
I'll find an excuse. Send me the details.
Gyrdon stood looking at the screen, as if he could get some sense out of it if he stared long enough. Zavirk sat with his chin propped on his hand, gazing up at the captain for orders.
Get a transcription of that to Colonel Solo right away.
Ben still wasn't clear what was happening, even though he thought Omis should have mentioned the approach to the Security Council. Can't the Chief of State talk to the Corellian Prime Minister?
Depends what he's talking about, said Gyrdon. And what he has in mind for Colonel Solo and Admiral Neothel.
If Gedgen could plot the assassination of the Queen Mother of Hapes and have Thrak and Sal Solo killed, then making Jason and Neothel disappear was just another routine job for him. Ben knew he had his answer about the necessity of his mission. Gyrdon leaned over Zavirk and tapped the console.
That conversation was 4 hours ago. Better check on the Chief of State's travel arrangements, because he hasn't informed us he's going off-world and needs a close protection squad.
You think he needs one? Asked Ben.
With Gedgen? He needs two.
Ben didn't know if he could mention Tenel Ka. It was always hard knowing who knew what inside the GAG.
Would he really try something with Chief Omis?
I think he does it out of habit.
just like I chew nerve sticks. Ben now had no idea if Cal Omis was bypassing the Senate illicitly to do a personal deal with the enemy, or walking into a trap like the one Gedgen had set for Tenel Ka, and Uncle Han's late, unlamented cousin, Thraken. Jason was right, as ever. Gedgen had to be stopped. Supreme Commander's Office, Senate Building, Coruscant. Jason read the transcript a third time and laid his datapad down on Neofel's desk. She had a hologram of Mon Cal on the wall behind her, all shimmering blue ocean and sinuous buildings emerging from the waves in floating cities. He wondered if she was homesick. Right now she was fresh back from a battle that hadn't gone as planned, and impatient to see Cal Omis about it. That meant she was receptive to ideas. He made a conscious effort not to influence her, because she wasn't the kind to fall for Jedi tricks, and it would only provoke her. "Nothing like a united front in wartime." He leaned back in the chair, fingers meshed behind his head. "So we're not the flavor of the month. Our glorious leader didn't exactly spring to our defense." Neofel's white uniform didn't look crumpled, even though she'd just disembarked from a warship fresh from a battle.
"Smacks of ingratitude, I'd say."
She wasn't one for humor. Jason knew enough about Mon Cal body language now to know she was angry. She kept rolling her head slightly, as if she was getting hot and her collar was pinching her neck. Her nostrils flared. That meant she was ripe for a few radical suggestions about Omis. He laid the bait. "You realize that when Gedgen says someone has to go, he doesn't mean a golden handshake and a framed certificate thanking them for loyal service."
"Spit it out, Jason."
"He was behind Sal Solo's premature death." She narrowed her eyes, heavy with sarcasm.
"I'm shocked, I tell you. Shocked!"
"And the attempt on the Hapen Queen Mother's life. My lover, mother of my daughter, my little darling. I wish I could see them. We're next." Neofel's nostrils closed tight for a second. It was a giveaway with Mon Cal's, a little sign that said they were surprised, and not in a good way.
"He wouldn't be stupid enough to try that."
"Right now I don't know what he'd try."
"Omis isn't a fool," she said. "He must have a good idea of what he's dealing with."
"What do you think he's up to?"
"All he wants to do is hold the Alliance together. He always thinks a few raps over the knuckles can bring naughty governments into line. Well, it didn't work with Corellia. And now he's watching the Alliance shrink a planet at a time."
She kept looking at the chrono on her desk.
"My rules say we should notify the chair of the Security Council about the meeting. He's beginning to feel sidelined as it is. I'm not sure what outcome that will have, though."
Jason kept Gasil sweet by delivering results on terrorism and not telling him anything he would have to deny knowing later. If he had serious designs on Omis's job, he hadn't shown any sign of it. Yet.
"Senator Gasil would simply task me to take care of it," Jason said. "I'm saving him the trouble of knowing. Plausible deniability."
"Do you enjoy the irony?"
"What?"
"Bypassing the Senate, about our head of state bypassing the Senate. Nice job with the procurement amendment, by the way. Slipped through like an oiled eel."
Neofel got up and wandered around her office,
long, webbed, bony fingers clasped behind her back. She had that upright bearing all the GA military had, regardless of species or spinal arrangement.
Now that we both have the ability to vary statutes, any statutes within budgetary limits, I imagine you've given its potential plenty of thought.
Jason wanted her to stand still and look at him, but she continued her slow amble around the office.
She plays these games beautifully. I'll have to be careful not to cross her.
It's an emergency kit, he said. If we need to, we can change any minor law. And we can also change any big one if we play this smart.
We, not I.
He thought it important to emphasize that they were partners.
For example, if HM3 were to amend the Emergency Measures Act to include in its scope the GAG's powers to detain heads of state, politicians, and any other individuals believed to be presenting a genuine risk to the security of the Galactic Alliance, and to seize their assets via the Treasury Orders Act, then I suspect people would look at Prime Minister Gedgen and nod approvingly.
You even talk like a legislator now.
But am I right?
Neothel turned. She couldn't smile like a human, but the amusement was written all over her face in a slight compression of the lips. Jason felt her shift from her perpetual wariness and impatience to a satisfied warmth, even triumph, for a brief moment.
That nobody will think of asking if the chief of state of the GA is covered by that amendment? Yes, Jason, you're right.
She made a gesture, holding her hand like a blade and weaving it through imaginary water.
That eel of yours will slip through again.
If I feel we have to act to restore stability and security, will you be standing with me? Will you stage a coup with me? Did I really say that?
Neothel did pause, but it wasn't the taken-aback pause of someone shocked by an outrageous proposal. Just a moment of sizing up Jason Solo.
You might have the GAG behind you, Jason. But you need the fleet, too, don't you? And the rest of the army.
Is that a yes?
It's an if things get worse. I put my allegiance to the GA before my allegiance to an individual.
I'm interested to see that the military will cross the line from carrying out the government's will into deciding policy.
In case you forget,
said Neothel softly,
the Office of Supreme Commander effectively combines the role of Defense Secretary and the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I am a politician. I also happen to be the most senior military officer.
She was his equal in maneuvering, but she didn't have force powers. He hoped he would never have to point that out to her.
It's time we had a chat with Omis, then.
Jason stood up and brushed down his black GAG fatigues with his hands.
Just to be certain. For all we know, he might be meeting Gedgen to whip out a blaster himself and effect another Corellian regime change.
Neothel followed him into the corridor that led to the Chief of State's suite. Elegant blue and gold marble and niche-studded walls with fine statues from across the galaxy. Jason found his heart pounding. Although he could control it, he let it race because it made him feel alive and human. These were momentous times, and if he cut himself off completely from normality, he might forget the magnitude of his task,
and the stakes. How can I forget? Ben has to die. When Jason thought in words, when he heard himself in his mind, he realized how his language was shifting. He was distancing himself from the reality. Ben has to die. It felt very different from, I have to kill him. Perhaps the Force was telling him it wouldn't be a simple betrayal of Ben's trust delivered with a lightsaber, but death by another route. If it has to happen, perhaps not by my hand. The doors to the Chief of State's suite slid open, and he walked into the quiet, thickly carpeted reception room with Neathel at his side. Not behind, not ahead, but exactly level with him. Omis was leaning over his aide's desk, talking in hushed tones.
"I'm sorry to have kept you waiting," he said, looking up. "Do come in."
Jason moved his chair so he wasn't forced to squint at Omis against the light from the window. So did Neathel. It was an eloquent, silent statement of who would have the upper hand, and they hadn't rehearsed it. Omis, a man finely attuned to the subtleties of body language and psychological advantage, radiated wariness in the Force. He knew he was dealing with a united front.
"You've seen the battle report, I take it?"
Neathel said.
"Yes."
Omis reached for a data pad, as if to reassure her that he had.
"Whether it was lucky timing on the Bothans' part, or a smart trap, the real issue now is how we deal with a Bethawi that's becoming even better armed and aggressive."
"Actually, it does matter if it was lucky or not," said Jason, "because it goes to the heart of the quality of our intelligence. I'm not happy with the quality of GA intel, which, if you recall, is why I wanted to form the GAG from selected personnel. Intel isn't up to the task we face now."
Omis looked weary.
"Okay, you've both got a complaint. Who's first?"
Neathel inclined her head politely, but Jason could feel her resolution forming a box around her almost like Durasteel. It was tangible.
"I'll keep it brief," she said. "We can't get involved in every little skirmish to keep obscure senators and tinpot heads of state in the Alliance. We're at overstretch. We couldn't maintain the Corellian blockade. And now we have the Bothans ramping up. Pick your battles, Chief of State. I can't fight them all."
Omis did his displacement act and poured himself a cup of caff from the jug on his desk. There was just one cup, and he didn't offer more.
"If we fail to show support to Alliance member worlds, then we lose them," he said. "This is basic numbers. We've been through all this. If more secede, then we've lost. The issue of how we maintain a joint defense force for the Alliance, which is what started this, in case we forget, then becomes academic."
"If we don't concentrate our forces on the worlds that present the most immediate and serious threat, then we'll be ground down a ship at a time. And we might not even be able to defend Coruscant if it comes to the worst."
"You think it might come to that?"
Omis didn't appear convinced. He glanced at Jason, but Jason kept his counsel.
"Is this about Coruscant in the end?"
"Of course it is," Neathel said. "It always is. The Alliance and Coruscant are indivisible, and that's half the problem for all the other worlds."
Omis turned to Jason.
"Your turn, Colonel."
"I share the Admiral's fears about overstretch,"
Now Jason slipped in his challenge, subtle and multi-layered, to give Omis a chance to come clean. He found himself hoping Omis didn't take it. Corellia is still the heart of this. I say we devote all our resources in the immediate term to an all-out assault on Corellia. Invasion, in fact. Destroy their industrial base and remove Gedgen and his cronies. The man's already had his predecessor killed and made an attempt on the Hapen Queen Mother. Jason paused a beat, because timing was everything. I've no doubt you'll be next. Jason felt Neafel's reaction, although her expression was set in neutral. Amusement, plus a little anxious excitement like preparing for battle. Omis felt suddenly more wary, but Jason couldn't tell if that was aimed at him or at the idea that Gedgen might be setting Omis up.
"You have intelligence to suggest that?"
Omis asked. Jason shook his head. "No, and I don't need it, or help from the Force to work it out. It's how Gedgen does business."
"If we launch that kind of assault on Corellia, it's something I should take to the Security Council. And even if they agree to it,
we're at war. You have all the legal powers to determine the conduct of the war with Admiral Neafel, as you see fit."
"Until it costs more credits," said Omis. "And once we are conspicuously focused on Corellia, what are Bathawi and Kamenor going to do? Answers on a small piece of flimsy, please."
Omis had the perfect excuse now to admit to the meeting with Gedgen. He could have said that he was going to give peace talks one last try. He could have said anything to indicate that he was going to talk terms with a state that showed no signs of understanding the words common good, and whose quietly lethal leader could have scared a Hutt gang lord. And, Jason thought, any smart politician might have suspected that his intelligence service spied on him, just as they spied on all the other senators. A little game of words. Omis could have made the suggestion and watched Jason's reaction, brazening it out to test if his clandestine call had been picked up. But he didn't, and his future and his fate were sealed.
"So where are we going with this?"
Neafel asked.
"Same strategy? Keep dividing up the fleet until we have one ship per theater?"
"I think a full assault on Corellia is madness," said Omis. "We might well have to consider it, but much later. In the meantime, my priority is to stop secessions from the Alliance from reaching the tipping point."
Jason sat feigning suppressed anger and disappointment. It had to be subtle, because Omis knew Jason's capacity for smiling self-control. But Omis needed to pick up the faintest whiff of dissent and savor it for a few moments. His suspicions would be aroused if Jason caved in too readily. Jason placed his hands squarely on the arms of the Apasha wood chair and eased himself to his feet.
"For the record, I think this is a big mistake, sir," he said, "and I would be happier if GAG could support our intelligence community in their efforts beyond Coruscant."
"I note your views, Colonel Solo, and I'm grateful for your strategic input so far."
Omis meshed his fingers and leaned on the desk, a gesture that said defensive more than it said resolute.
"The GAG's remit is domestic, though. I appreciate your concern for the quality of our intelligence."
Jason didn't catch Neafel's eye. He walked out, followed closely by her, and said nothing until they were back in her office. Well?
Not good, she said.
She wandered up to the window to watch the traffic streaming in orderly lines in the skylanes around the Senate District.
Not exactly open with us, is he?
I never told him we have GAG personnel operating on Corellia. So we're even.
We can't sustain the current strategy. Perhaps I should talk to Senator Gasil and get it referred to the Security Council.
And then we divert our energies into an internal power struggle with Omis, while we have a war to fight. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that if you take a shot at someone, you keep firing until they can no longer return fire. Wound them, and you have an angry enemy who knows your position.
I know where you're heading with this, Jason.
You know I'm right.
That doesn't make it any easier.
If he does a deal with Gedgen, we're not just back to square one. The Alliance is in a worse position than when it started.
And we'll be out of the game.
That's academic. Jason almost asked Neothel if she had children, and then realized he had almost done the most stupid thing imaginable, reveal his constant fears for the future of his own daughter, a child whose paternity had to stay hidden. He recovered fast, astonished at his weakness. Because the game will be recurring wars.
Or Omis might end up with a vibrablade in his throat.
He's insane to meet Gedgen face to face without close protection anyway. He hasn't asked for it from us. He hasn't asked CSF either.
GA Intel?
No. We tap their comms, too.
You're a source of constant revelation, Jason Solo.
Are you in?
Say it.
Jason looked around the room, trying to look as if he was simply thinking, but suspicious that someone else might be doing to him what he did to them. Eavesdrop electronically. Was Neothel setting him up? No. He was sure he could sense bugs in a room. There were none. You know what I'm proposing.
I don't, actually. Not in detail. Say it.
Regime change. Too late. But he couldn't sense any risk. His logical brain was the paranoid whispering voice, not his force senses. He realized he'd become less instinct-driven and more rational, and that was the problem. Thinking too much, feeling too little, just like Lumia says. We remove him from office long enough to get this war won, and then hand it back to Senator Gasil when the situation is stable so that new elections can take place. His words emerged like uninvited strangers, and he didn't even believe himself. Neothel made a little splutter that could have been laughter.
I get the removal. It's the gap in the middle between remove and elections that fascinates me.
We run the GA during the interim as a duumvirate. No dictatorship. Joint control. Neothel indicated her uniform and then reached out to jab a bony finger into the rank tab on his shoulder.
Military coup. That's what it's called. Let's not prevaricate.
Okay. I remove him, and you take over. Alone.
I don't think so. Duumvirate sounds best to me.
Jason liked two, too, was the Sith way. Knowing Neothel's ambition for the chief's office, he'd have the same circling, edgy power struggle with her as a Sith master with an apprentice who was expected and encouraged to plot to overthrow him. But he would rule as Sith Lord in due course, when the GA and elections were academic, and she would administer the state. That would satisfy her. "I'll take care of Gedgen, by the way," he said. "He's a massively destabilizing influence, and removing him will throw Corellia into disarray."
"How will you take care of Omis?"
"I'll remove him by house arrest."
"Deposed heads of state tend to become martyrs and hostages."
"We can't be seen to kill our own. And framing Gedgen for it did occur to me. But it's not necessary. We need to show ourselves as civilized people working within the law."
"With a coup?"
"Under the law, as the law will stand, it won't be."
"Ah, I forgot."
No, she hadn't. He knew that.
"Your amendment to the law?"
"I'm tabling it for next week, through HM3.
"And in the meantime?"
"Leave that to me. I'll have someone there when Omis meets Gedgen." Jason checked his datapad. "He needs only a day to do his business with Gedgen. No more. So, my people have him under surveillance, ready to move. Then we have evidence to present to Gesell."
"And then you arrest him?"
"I was thinking I might arrest him at the same time you present the evidence to Gesell. When we move, we have to move fast. No room to be outmaneuvered." Neothel let out a long breath. Jason waited.
"I'll be ready to move on your signal. Make sure you keep me up to speed with all this, won't you?"
It was done. Jason's takeover was in place. He had the GAG at his back, and Neothel would deliver the fleet as well as the army. With the right presentation of Omis selling out to the Corellians, it would be a very orderly coup. There was no need for unnecessary bloodshed. That was what this was all about. An end to violence, chaos, and instability. That was worth everything he was risking. Jason took an air taxi back to a plaza a few minutes' walk from the GAG HQ. Just another citizen. No sleek black GA transport. No privilege. Either the driver didn't recognize the uniform, or he hesitated to say, "Here, you're the chief of the secret police, aren't you?" It was a silent, contemplative journey. It was time to make sure nothing went wrong, if manifest destiny could go wrong. He opened his comlink and called Lumia. "Shira," he said, aware of the pilot up front, "I need you to do a job for me."